and welcome to this episode of the Newcastle Oral History Unit podcast. Throughout this series, we will broadcast regular episodes that feature some of the fantastic interviews that we have conducted over the last couple of years. Episodes will range from project-specific discussions to conversations with leading international oral historians about their own practice and future directions within the field. Please feel free to contact us at any time via email, where we're at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk, or follow us on Twitter, where we're at @NCL_oralhistory. My name is Andy Clark, and this episode comes from a remote conversation that I had with oral historian and activist Fred Burrell during the coronavirus lockdown. Fred is a PhD student at the Centre for Oral History and Digital Storytelling at Concordia University in Montreal. Both his research and his activism revolves around working class studies, housing rights and gentrification in Montreal. Throughout the conversation, we discuss the realities of doing research during the lockdown, the links between oral history and activism, Fred's involvement in political and social movements in the city, and the ethical considerations of co-production and oral history research. I hope you enjoy. Hello, Fred. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How's lockdown going in Montreal?
Lockdown is, I imagine it's going the same as everywhere else. It's for those of us in the middle class and the kind of upper stratas of the working class, you know, we're doing yoga and being bored. And for everybody else, it's a bit of a nightmare.
How's the weather currently in Montreal?
The weather's been good, actually. I mean, it's funny because Montreal is a city where it's, the winters are tough, but the people say you really got to be here for the summer to get a sense of what a brilliant city it is. So I feel like the social distancing or the physical distancing is becoming harder every day with the more nice the weather is. So the police are going around giving out $6,000 tickets to people in the park, so we can expect that to continue, I think.
Wow. And I suppose one of the things I'm interested in is you're currently doing your PhD in history at Concordia. Mm-hmm. What's it like being doing a PhD during this time? What's changed in terms of your working practices?
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm a PhD student in the history department, but I also like a lot of graduate students. I work on a variety of research contracts and small teaching contracts and whatnot. So there's been the navigating the wage labor part of it, figuring out how to teach from a distance and a lot of kind of like personal support work of undergraduates dealing with the crisis. In terms of my own work, We have a university ban right now on human to human research, so there's no oral history possible that's not online, and I do oral histories of working class and unemployed movements in a part of the city called Saint-Henri, which is down in the southwest of Montreal. So people are not, by and large, equipped to be doing, Zoom interviews or whatever. So that's put a bit of a cramp in my style. The other thing is that there's just a lot to do in terms of being involved in, in different social movement aspects here in the city, trying to make sure that everybody has access to, government supports, everybody has access to healthcare, which is not the case in Canada for people who don't have citizenship status or permanent residency. And trying to organize to support all the tenants, who are falling through the cracks of those income support programs, and who are not able to pay their rent at the moment. So it's a busy time, and PhD stuff has taken a little bit of a backseat for me. But I try to give it an hour or two per day, but I haven't been getting more than that.
That's actually a really interesting point you made. One of the things we've been talking about is how to do remote interviewing, but I think the point that you touched on about the
technological infrastructure that different groups have can make that increasingly difficult. And I mean, you touched on it there, but if you just tell us a bit about your PhD research and what the focus of that project is.
Absolutely. So I worked a long time as a community organizer in the Tenants Association down in a neighborhood called Saint-Henri or Saint-Henri in English in the southwest of Montreal, which into the 70s was kind of the heart of industrial production in Canada. You know, like many cities across North America and Western Europe, deindustrialization hit Montreal hard. And, you know, for the last 30 years or so, that neighborhood has pretty much been abandoned by various levels of government. In the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a heavy reinvestment of finance and speculative real estate capital in the gentrification of the neighborhood, involving, you know, the displacement of the traditional working class community in that area. So my PhD research is oral histories of residents, tenants of St. Henry, who have been involved in different forms of tenant organizing and organizing for welfare rights and healthcare in the neighborhood over the years, primarily interested in the kind of the period of transition between labor organizing and community organization-based kind of rights-based organizing through deindustrialization, to see the kind of legacies of a working class sensibility or an industrial sensibility in the ways that people relate to gentrification in the 21st century context.
So you say that came on the back of your work as a community organizer. How did you get involved in the community activism side of things in St. Henry?
Well, actually, I moved there like many students do. About 15 years ago now, without really knowing where I lived or anything, you know, not knowing what the context was or the history was of the neighborhood, and not really speaking the language. It's kind of a majoritarian French language area. And then, so just through the process of getting to know my neighbors and getting involved in different struggles, then I became a member of the Tenants Association in the neighborhood, and was involved for a few years in pushing for the creation of social housing, pushing back against gentrification. And then there was a job that opened up there, and I applied and kind of didn't expect to get it, but got the job, and you know, just became even more kind of entrenched in the struggle in that area. And then I had started a long time ago. I started a bit of a PhD with PhD research with Stephen Hayek Concordia, and I had the, you know, at the time I was in my early 20s, and I was not, I really felt like everything I did had to be like really urgent and important. So I was not able to maintain the long haul PhD life, and so dropped out at that point. And then I came back to study with Stephen in 2016, to kind of, you know, I want to step back a little and think about the connections between the ongoing organizing that I was doing and you know, what that means for working class studies, and also, you know, thinking about how historians can contribute to ongoing social struggle and political struggle.
Yeah. I mean, what's the relationship, do you think, between the oral history work you're doing and the activism that you're still involved in? Because there is that conversation within oral history that is fundamentally an activist practice, but it's trying to balance that kind of academic side with the activism side. What's your experience of that?
I mean, I would say that I'm not very good at that balance. You know, I think probably as a lot of oral historians are doing right now in their quarantine state, I'm like, the time that I have dedicated to my work is spent doing transcriptions. And I'm, you know, I'm listening to the interviews and I'm like, wow, I really talk a lot, you know. It's not, but it's not like, it's not like talking to people that I don't know, you know, it's, I'm having a conversation with people that I organize with and people who are my friends and my neighbors. So, you know, I think when you're involved in social movements, you know, you often kind of get demands from or requests from academics, you know, like the sort of participatory observation type situations. And I've always sort of felt like, well, why don't you just participate? You know, like what's the need to observe? So I feel I am actually now myself in that kind of participant observation scenario, and I feel consistently pretty awkward about it. But I do think that you know, it's helpful, I think, especially through oral history, to be able to promote what is essentially, I think, you know, grassroots political analysis of both of the evolution of movements and the experience of deindustrialization, but also of the contemporary context. And so I try as much as possible for my work to be kind of promoting that kind of collective analysis of the situation. And I guess, you know, in some ways that's a lot of what political organizing is too, right? It's people, you know, using their kind of individual time and energy and gifts in order to raise up the voices of directly affected people and kind of promote the analysis that we come to through collective discussion and organizing.
I suppose one of the things that comes to mind when you're talking about it is that idea of the co-production of knowledge.
Yeah.
So how does that work in practice in terms of your practice and working directly with people you're involved in activism with? How do you collectively analyze those discourses?
Well, it's a good question, and I'm afraid that I don't really have much of a fleshed out answer. As much as possible, what I've been trying to do is make the research that I'm doing relevant to the ongoing organizing work. So say for example, you know, I haven't finished my dissertation yet, but some of the interviews that I've done, I put them together to make about a half hour, 40 minute documentary about the history of tenant organizing in the neighborhood for the 50th anniversary of the Tenants Association, which was in December of 2019. And I've also made an audio walk, which is kind of like a guided downloadable tour of the neighborhood around the themes of gentrification and kind of political resistance to that, based on interviews with people. So I guess what I'm, in the kind of the public facing aspects of my work, I've been trying to remove myself as much as possible and just use that work to, obviously there is the kind of the guiding curating hand, you know, but to promote the voices and the analysis of people who don't often get listened to on, you know, on the questions of neighborhood transformation.
And what are some of the kind of, because I'm really interested in doing research on activism while activism's ongoing, and I'm really interested in what kind of campaigns have you been involved in over the last couple of years that have ran parallel with your research?
Yeah, I mean, we've been really involved, you know, for a long time in the southwest of the city, campaigning for the construction of social housing. So along, you know, the basic lines that the private market is not able to guarantee the right to housing. And so, you know, in the kind of immediate post-industrialization period, this when the neighborhood was left to abandon by various level of governments, this was kind of along the lines of, you know, you're leaving us to live in kind of slum housing. Over the last 15 years, it's been transferred into a struggle against gentrification. So along the lines of like non-market housing is kind of the only way to stop the speculative real estate process. The big struggle that I've been involved in the last couple years, is there's only one remaining abandoned factory that hasn't been converted into a kind of either loft space or condo space along the Lachine Canal, which was the kind of aquatic industrial artery through the south part of the city up until 1970. There's only this one massive abandoned factory left, and we've been pushing to have the city buy that and then convert it into a kind of a mixed use project of locally owned business, 200 odd social housing units, an urban farm, and an industrial history museum. So we've been kind of using the historical scholarship and the historical angle as a selling point for the social housing project. So we've got a small research grant to kind of start doing interviews this summer with, I mean, we'll see now in the context of the pandemic with this committee of myself and other residents of the neighborhood, and thinking through how we can make a working class history museum and use that as part of a strategy against real estate speculation.
What kind of response have you had from the city to these proposals?
Well, it's interesting because right now there's the municipal government is a social democratic party called Projet Montréal. But they're social democratic in the sense of they have a kind of a relatively interesting discourse around equality, but they are really quite married to finance capital. Mm-hmm. So they've been nominally supportive, but when push comes to shove, have been pretty quick to look for the exit. That said, there is a fairly big movement around it, and they are have been at least somewhat more susceptible to popular pressure than previous municipal administrations over the last 15 years. And with the context of the pandemic, it's kind of all bets are off in terms of the ways in which essentially finance capital is structured and the extent to which governments are willing to go in terms of like financial stimulus. So, we're sort of kind of trying to get a handle on what's happening and what governments are, what the provincial and municipal governments here are liable to do in terms of construction of housing and especially non-market housing. And from there, try to devise a new strategy for the new context.
Hmm. I mean, in terms of the campaign for the former industrial site in the Lachine Canal, what kind of support base do you have, and what do you back the plans?
Well, I mean, it's the campaign itself is a kind of a coalition between neighborhood organizations. And local tenants, people who live essentially at the base of that factory. And it's interesting because when you start talking about industrial heritage, you get kind of like a bunch of heritage activists and people who are kind of concerned with questions of architectural preservation, etc. I mean, my kind of feeling on the thing has always been, if we can preserve it and make a socially relevant project out of it, great. If we can't, let's just knock it down and then build something new. That's fine too. But it's been an interesting learning process for me because people who live in the neighborhood around the base are in fact like quite attached to the structure and it really means something to them. Even though the factory itself, there was. It's a malting factory. It was the Canada Malting, which is malting factories themselves are kind of like giant machines. So they, even at their, even when they're in full industrial production, they don't actually have that many employees. So it was never a huge industrial employer in the neighborhood. But the fact that it's the last standing remnant of the Lachine Canal at different points in its history has had up to like 100 different industries along it. And so the fact that it's the last standing remnant of that past means that people are very attached to it as a symbol. So, you know, I've been learning a lot as well about, you know, maybe my kind of dismissal of aesthetic considerations is its own sort of privilege, you know, and that people in the neighborhood actually do care a lot about preserving that kind of industrial facade as well.
Yeah, I think that touches on what you said earlier about other industrial sites have been preserved and have been converted, but as is the case with many of these projects, have been converted so that only a certain few can actually access and enjoy them.
Yeah.
That's certainly the feeling that I got when I was in Montreal the last time. Going back to your research, I mean, how do you reflect on the process of interviewing people that you are alongside with and the struggle and you campaign together? What do you think about the dynamic between the interviewer and interviewee, and what for you are the kind of main strengths of that?
I mean, the main strength of it is that I think that kind of the flow and the dynamic of the interview is often a bit less stilted than it has been my experience in kind of, you know, going into interviews cold without kind of prior relationships developed with people. Of course, it has its disadvantages as well, right? There's lots of people that I would love to interview who have super, well, not lots of people, but some people that I would love to interview who I know have, you know, a huge wealth of knowledge and analysis, but, you know, because of basically essentially interpersonal conflicts in political organizing, like, they're not going to want to talk to me, you know, like, because I've been associated with a different take on a particular issue, or so, you know, it complicates it when you're part of the community as well. I think it's interesting. There's a lot of things like that get said before and after the interview, but not during the interview. You know, there's things that people are not comfortable doing. And it's also, I think, in my mind, the jury is still out on whether or not this project in its kind of completed form will be significantly relevant to people. I think so far, I think people are kind of happy to be interviewed because they feel like, you know, they're helping me out with my school project, you know, which they absolutely are, and they're super appreciated. But I think that they have yet to, by and large, other than some of the more public-facing things, you know, with the documentary and the audio walk, but the actual dissertation itself, I don't think people have huge expectations that it'll be super relevant to them. And I think that, you know, that's up to me to kind of, you know, change their expectations of their view of that.
No, definitely. Again, it makes me think about possibilities for, you know, co-writing things with interviews. Something that you've thought about in terms of that kind of co-authored pieces.
I mean, I've been thinking about the ethics of kind of international travel, you know. I mean, beyond the ecological issues, I mean, Andy, you and I have gotten to know each other over the last couple of years through a variety of kind of international level conferences, speaking about oral history and working class studies and deindustrialization. And you know, I don't have any money as a grad student, but I do have a credit card that I put things on, and the university reimburses me for that travel, right? And I think about when I'm there, like, oh yeah, you know, I know that my neighbor would love to be like in the UK somewhere or somewhere in the US talking about this thing, and here I am presenting this paper, right? And so it's thinking about not only the kind of the ways in which oral history is sort of you know, runs the risk of being extractive in terms of knowledge creation, but how it is, it's actually extractive in terms of, like, you know, me turning the experience of these people into what is essentially a marketable product, like, not worth that much in terms of actual wealth, but I mean, in the ways in which, you know, like, I'm using the presentation that I gave at that conference to apply for a grant or to apply for a job position, which, you know, knock on wood, will turn into a stable income for me. So I think those are hard ethical questions that need to be looked at, not only in terms of knowledge production, but also in terms of like material relations between people. And I don't have any good answers about that, but I do think that co-writing is one thing, and I think it's also including people as co-researchers as well, right? In grant applications and creating employment positions for people as much as possible, even though there is not much of that to go around.
No, you've hit the nail on the head in terms of what my thinking's been regards this recently. One of the things that I really like the idea of co-authorship with interviewees, but I get paid for doing that and they don't. And it sounds as if you come from a kind of similar place in terms of the academics, the one that gets to enjoy the fruits of that, whereas I sometimes feel we can expect too much from interviewees, that they'll want to be involved in the process.
But yeah, you got to be careful that it doesn't just become about like your own guilt either, you know, like it's important for that to be an actually transformative relationship and not just kind of a window dressing on your on your activist guilt.
you talked about people you have not been able to interview, but what's the general uptake been like when you've approached activists about taking part in the project?
I mean, it's interesting because it's people have been involved for a really long time. Often, sometimes it's people who are newer to the struggle as well. But by and large, this has been my experience of my own activism and research work. It could be the case in other spheres, I don't know. But by and large, people in my world are not super used to the concept of themselves being experts on anything. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a process in which there's a lot of uncertainty. It's like, well, what do you want to talk about? Or I'm not sure what I would have to bring to that. And then it's been interesting, actually, you know, once I've done interviews with a few people, then if they've been around, where I've been asking another person if they'd want to do it, then, you know, the first person I did an interview with explains what it's about. You know, they're like, oh no, they want to talk to you. He wants to talk to you about your experiences and, you know, kind of what you think about stuff. It's not necessarily like how much you remember about, you know, a specific policy that we're pushing on. It's more about like what's your general take on stuff. And then from there, essentially the further I've gotten into it, the more people are comfortable with participating.
So I wonder, one of the things I've found in my research that touches on what you said in terms of people not wanting to, or don't think they've got anything to add to the historical record. Have you noticed any kind of gender or racial breakdown in terms of people that have come back with those sentiments of not having anything to offer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting, the composition of tenant organizing in my neighborhood heavily skewed towards women. I guess because it's a political struggle. I mean, part of my analysis is kind of the analyzing the reorientation of political struggle from kind of productive to reproductive issues. Mm-hmm. How essentially political activism with factory shutdowns became about kind of household survival. And so there's absolutely a gendered breakdown in terms of who is willing to talk about what, right? And, you know, it's funny, like in St. Henry, it's a neighborhood that has traditionally been associated with kind of organized crime. There's a lot of, it hasn't been the case for many years, but in the late 70s, there was a kind of a Quebec-wide provincial commission on organized crime, which essentially dealt with one or two mafia families, connections to Montreal and New York, and this family-based crime syndicate in St. Henry. And so there's a lot of things that people won't openly say, but they they kind of talk about in a coded way, and that ends up being very gendered. You know, like I've done interviews with people where they kind of talk about who they hung out with. You know, like I often ask them, like, you know, St. Henry has this kind of reputation in this time of being kind of rough. Or, you know, what did you think? And they're kind of like, oh no, you know, it was relatively safe. And then you kind of ask them where they hung out, and they're like, well, I went, you know, my kind of place was this bar, and the bar is the place in the provincial report that is like, you know, this is where X pounds of heroin were sold out of or whatever, you know. And so the discourses of safety are always kind of interesting, and actually it becomes super gendered now in terms of gentrification, that women who are in their, you know, 60s, early 70s, who talk about a period which was quite renowned as being dangerous in the neighborhood, with kind of nostalgia and say that they felt relatively safe, who now don't go out of their homes at night because there's all kinds of young men around who are like in the neighborhood for the bars or for the restaurants. So yeah, these things kind of get teased out, and as I go along, I feel like I've also gotten somewhat better at figuring things out. Like, beginning, I was kind of asking about, like, you know, how do you feel like this impacts you as a woman? And the answers were universally like, well, I'm not sure that has anything to do with it. But then, you know, when I kind of learned that you have to come up against questions in a sort of a sideways manner, you know, you kind of got to talk about, like, well, who did, who does the laundry in your house, and, you know, kind of figuring out ways to ask those questions in less academic forms has also helped me learn a lot about those things.
Yeah, it's asking around the question rather than asking the question, isn't it, to try and get to.
Yeah.
So we started the conversation talking about the impact of coronavirus on your PhD. What about the impact on housing in Montreal? What's been the main impacts, particularly in places like St. Henry that have witnessed extensive gentrification? What's been the housing impact?
Yeah, well, before the pandemic, Montreal has already been in for a couple of years now, officially in a housing crisis, which here we take to mean when the vacancy rate on the rental market is below 3%. And it's been floating just, you know, a few decimal points above 0% now for a couple of years, which means that prices are through the roof, and people are often in a form of kind of hidden homelessness, and that they're moving from place to place, or they're crashing on their partner's couch or whatever. So the housing situation, especially for kind of poor and middle income people, has been really, really precarious now in the city for about 5 years, probably a bit longer. And the coronavirus has come into this situation and kind of dropped a bomb on it, in the sense that, you know, all of the minimum wage working people in the city, outside of people working in grocery stores, have lost their jobs, right? So I think the official statistics, it's kind of hard to tell because you have numbers from the landlord lobbies and then numbers from the government, which are not quite the same, but it seems to be in Montreal around, I don't know, like a quarter of tenants on the rental market were not able to pay their rent in April. And there are hundreds of thousands of people in Canada who are not eligible for the federal benefits for a variety of reasons, some of which include citizenship requirements, others of which include the amount of money that you made before this thing. So basically, thousands of people in the city are falling through the cracks. So what we're really worried about at this point is that unpaid rent. For the moment, there's a moratorium on evictions, on legal evictions at any rate. But what we're really worried about is that there will be, as soon as the kind of governing body, which here is called the Régie du Logement or the Rental Board, begins its functions again, there's just going to be a wave of COVID eviction. And there's nowhere for those people to go in the city. And that's gonna be, you know, thousands of households, in fact. So we're kind of, at the moment, we're kind of scrambling to, in other words, we tried a bit to organize this, the concept of rent strike in the city, but I would say that this has been largely unsuccessful, not because people are paying when they don't have the money to, but because the tenant movement is like slow to move to new directions in terms of its political campaigning, and you know the turnaround of this new context has been very quick in terms of like consulting the different decision making bodies and whatnot. But really, what we're trying to do now is get organized so that, you know, we can defend all of the thousands of people who are going to be facing evictions at the end of this scenario.
Yeah, it's pretty much the kind of same situation here, and it's almost hoping that there'll be a moral reckoning at the end of it, that actually you can't just make thousands of people homeless at the stroke of a brush. And one of the things that I have been reading about, and I know it's something you're interested in, is the idea of the Airbnbization of neighbourhoods. And one of the things that this pandemic seems to have exploited is the idea that people just let out their spare room, and it's really brought to the fore that actually buying property for Airbnb is a mass-produced product. Do you foresee any change in terms of legislation over Airbnb in Montreal? Because it is a city that has a lot of its housing stock, you know, devoted to that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. Airbnb, in the last week, has requested and been denied bailout packages at the provincial level. As far as I know, the jury is still out on whether or not the federal government will step in. But you know, this has really, as you say, this has really revealed the true nature of the so-called sharing economy. That is, in fact, you know, it's a massive business, right? And so, as industry representatives asking for bailouts from the government, you're no longer talking about, you know, the person renting out their spare room or whatever, right? And this is many, many, many kind of like, oh, woe is me, crocodile tears have gone, have come to the front in this moment in which, you know, the young entrepreneur will say, you know, like, I've just bought 4 properties and I was running all these Airbnbs and this is going to ruin me forever. So hopefully this will, you know, spur the city to see that, in fact, you know, Airbnbs need to be outlawed in Montreal, probably everywhere, but definitely in Montreal, which is where I'm more familiar with. But we'll see. I mean, I think everything's a little bit up in the air right now, because the housing market in a capitalist economy is pretty much you know, in many ways, it's kind of a physical manifestation of the stock market. In Canada, our kind of two economic drivers are resource extraction, usually on contested indigenous territory, and personal household debt, which is essentially mortgages, right? And banks are making billions of dollars off of buying and selling shares of these mortgages on the stock market. So this current sort of like liquidity crisis and income crisis, I think is incurring pretty large losses on the stock market at the moment. And it's really unclear like whether or not, the government is going to move to some sort of recognition that this way of organizing the concept of shelter is just completely backwards. But I think there's at least, you know, there is kind of a new, I would say, level of consciousness in the city that, you know, organizing housing around a profit motive is just kind of cruel and unnecessary. So we'll see what the possibilities will be.
Yeah, and I just kind of want to use this opportunity to publicly say hello to my landlord, who hasn't been in touch once since this began. I'm doing okay. I suppose moving away from coronavirus, which is what we're all talking about all the time, and back to your research and activism, what pieces of advice would you give to an activist oral historian about doing a good project that's also attentive to their responsibilities as an activist?
That's a good question. I mean, I think part of it is taking the time that's necessary. You know, I think, and especially like in the UK context, you know, you folks have got your 3-year PhDs, and there's a, you know, there's a lot of pressure to get in and done. Here, fortunately, it's a little bit more normalized to be, you know, to take a little bit more time. I'm coming up on the end of my 4th year here, and I think I'll be done by the end of 5. But that's, you know, that's totally normal, and I think people would be surprised if I did it quicker. And I think that actually, I think taking time is really a crucial element of doing projects in responsible ways. And you know, it's funny, we talk about that a lot as oral historians, but I think actually, you know, just historians in general probably could think about these ethical issues in useful ways, in ways that would be useful to the quality of our work. You know, it's a, you know, you want to take as much time, I think, really, for, you know, someone who's, you know, researching the Renaissance or whatever, they should be taking as much time to be kind of responsible to their sources as we as oral historians are, and just kind of thinking about, you know, our making our scholarship be really about kind of quality and relevance rather than kind of like, well, we got to get this thing done because like I have this grant deadline afterward. And I absolutely, that's the, you know, those are the kind of the material exigencies that structure our lives. And it's not about, you know, anybody doing what they need to do to survive. There's no judgment on that. But I think historical writing is generally, at least for myself, I find if I can get my brain and my activity to slow down a little bit, what comes out on the other end is usually more pleasant to read and more relevant to the people who participated in the project.
Mm-hmm. So my last question has been complicated somewhat by the pandemic, but I'll try it anyway. What's the next stages of your research project once we're able to get out and do things again?
Well, I mean, at this point, I've gotten, you know, I've done a fair few interviews. I want to do probably 10 to 15 more. There's some folks that I have in mind that we've talked about doing interviews, but I haven't had a chance to do it yet. Really, what I'm coming up against, the main hurdle at this point is analyzing, because the kind of the fine details of the process of restructuring of capital accumulation. So in government archives and in corporate archives, there's a lot of stuff available in provincial archives about the kind of purposeful reorientation of accumulation from industrial production to real estate speculation. But it's not classified according to those categories, right? So it's a lot of shifting through documents of different bureaucratic committees and whatnot, and trying to kind of suss out those political patterns. So that's my next big challenge. But yeah, I'm hoping to be done by the end of summer 2021. That's my new goal.
Excellent. And do you have any more plans for public-facing activities with the campaign group?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of my own historical scholarship, we're really pushing on founding this museum. And so even before we have the building, we're working on kind of interactive historical exhibits in different parts around the neighborhood, kind of guided tours of different stuff. Around the history of struggle and industrial labor. And I would like to, once this is all done, I kind of dipped my toes into the water of filmmaking for the very first time around this 50th anniversary of tenant struggle in the neighborhood. And I learned a lot, and I realized I still have a lot more to learn, but I would like to make a longer full-length documentary on kind of the history of struggle in the neighborhood as well. So that's a dream, and hopefully I'll be able to include it in my final dissertation project as well.
Fantastic. Well, that's, as I say at the end of every interview, that's everything I've got to ask. Is there anything I've missed?
No, I don't think so. Thanks a lot for the chat. It was good to talk to you.
Brilliant, Fred. Right, thanks for joining us, and take care and stay safe, and hopefully see you soon.
Absolutely. Take care, Andy.
Cheers, mate.
Bye.
This has been a podcast from the Newcastle Oral History Unit. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. And remember, you can contact us via email at oralhistory@newcastle.ac.uk and follow us on Twitter. We're at oralhistory_NCL.